You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 7th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mashambe Lambright, Executive Director of One Voice Mississippi. But first, John Bartlett, journalist and co-host of the Marauders podcast on the failure of a new Chilean constitution to be adopted by a plebiscite. Meanwhile, new report, Trump had stolen documents that included documents on foreign nations' nuclear capabilities in the Mar-a-Lago janitor's closet or wherever he was keeping it.
The last place you'd think to look for it.
Steve Bannon to surrender to New York authorities over his build a wall scam. A judge in New Mexico orders removal of a county commissioner, the first time ever, who participated in the January 6th assault because he was an insurrectionist. Senate Republicans in crisis control as the Rick Scott, Mitch McConnell feud boils over. 56% of Americans now say inflation is causing them hardship. Seattle teachers on strike. And rape and incest out of that South Carolina abortion ban bill as exceptions. Meanwhile, in Texas, polling shows that its abortion ban is unpopular. Speaking of Texas, this just breaking, a U.S. district judge in Texas rules that requiring employer health coverage to include drugs preventing HIV transmission is an unconstitutional violation of religious freedom. UN team calls for ceasefire at the Ukrainian nuclear plant. Uline Nu forgoes a third-party run in New York's 10th congressional district. And Maura Healey is on track to be Massachusetts' first female governor.
Dude.
All that and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is a very, very early, I mean, it feels early. Well, I'm not going to say it because it's Emma Vigeland's...
Oh, it's early hump day. It's hump day.
Yeah. There she is, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello.
There she is with her specially coined phrase.
Yep.
Hump day. I'm still getting used to that.
It's tough, but it'll catch on eventually.
Yep. There you go. Snuck up on us because, of course, Monday was Labor Day. Thanks for joining us. We got a lot to get to today. Couple of great guests. First, you know, it is almost impossible to ignore the weather, the extreme weather that and flooding and heat that we're seeing. California is on the brink of rolling blackouts because of the extraordinary heat there. There's extraordinary heat throughout the parts of the West and some in the Southwest. Meanwhile, Pakistan is almost one third underwater, 33 million people displaced. a couple of thousand minimum dead at this point. And, you know, we just did pass some climate legislation in this country. Necessary, but insufficient. Story in the New York Times today about clean energy projects surging after the climate bill passage because, you know, this ends up subsidizing a lot of things and making the profit more assured. Government's very good at doing that. They did it for the vaccinations as well. And yet nothing that we have seen from this country or frankly around the world is really going to be, you know, getting close to what is needed. Here is a plea from the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the UN headquarters in New York City yesterday to that effect.
There is a lot of attention on the war of Ukraine, but people tend to forget there is another war, the war we are waging on nature, and nature is striking back, and climate change is supercharging the destruction of our planet. Pakistan, Chad, the Horn of Africa, where the drought is causing famine, all these things represent an enormous threat to all of us. Today, it is Pakistan. Tomorrow, it can be anywhere else. To deal with climate change, that is the defining issue of our time, with a business-as-usual approach, is pure suicide. Thank you very much.
Happy Wednesday, folks. I mean, you know, this is... We could do our show every day about the urgency of this crisis. And we don't, just like everybody, I think we just... I mean, that is it's almost like the human brain does not have the capacity to forefront something like this that is so massive and so urgent.
It's just in the background.
And so we just keep it in the background. And but that's the reality.
And it could happen anywhere, as he says. But we know that in certain areas it's going to be felt most acutely, particularly the global south, because a lot of what... The effects of climate change are going to be felt on lines of power and colonialism because these areas just don't have the resources and ability to combat it in the way that the United States does. And that's not to say that, you know, people in this country are facing the effects of climate change as well, but it's just going to be much more difficult to combat in areas that have been traditionally exploited
and much more more difficult to adapt to. And of course, when in addition to things like the intense heat, I mean, you know, at one point it gets to like you can't live there for 6 months out of the year. But on top of which, we're going to get a lot of second order problems. But hopefully there'll be a second bite at the apple following November. I don't know, but when hope springs eternal, I guess. That's the thing, is you hit this wall where it's like there's only so much that we can do. With that said, today's program, good move into our sponsors. Yeah, it's always like a tough decision to open up with something like that in the program. But every now and then it's important, I think, to remind everyone. Good news is, if you need to chill after that, one of our sponsors today is having a 30% sale.
Whoa.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen. SunsetLakeCBD.com. They are announcing a new product. It is CBD gummies. But it is also, they call them Good Vibe Gummies. It is a full-spectrum gummy crafted with a blend of CBD and hemp-derived
THC.
I was thinking about that. Like, like telephone Hector Charlie or something like that. But apparently, 3 milligrams of tete is perfectly legal. Hemp-derived tete, perfectly legal. Each Good Vibe gummy is infused with that 3 milligrams of tete and 30 milligrams of CBD. And Good Vibe gummies, perfect for taking the edge off after a long day or relaxing with friends and family.
Or during one.
Or first thing in the morning.
That was the thing, is that like I put one, they came this morning. I guess they came at the end of day yesterday, so we're going to try this tonight for sleeping. I'm going to see how that goes. But I put one on everybody's desk, and are you eating one right now?
Yep.
It's like I shouldn't put this on Matt's desk.
It's a good mango flavor.
Does it taste good?
It does.
See, that's what I'm also worried.
Should we all take it?
Well, I'm worried because if I have one, I know what happens.
How's the whole
thing? I'll eat the entire thing in one bite. I can't do that. But they also had they have all sorts of other products. I mean, I got my hemp body lotion, and these guys at Sunset Lake, they know me very well. You'll see that unscented.
Yeah.
You guys can have the scented ones, but you can't wear it in the office. Anyway, Sunset Lake CBD is spreading the good vibes by offering 30% off of all gummies. So that includes these gummies, but also we have some of the melatonin ones.
Mm-hmm. Which I snagged as soon as I saw them available in the office because I'm getting up for an early flight tomorrow.
You really did snag everything, didn't you? And the regular sour ones.
No, you left these for me.
I know.
I snagged three additional products.
And then you grabbed the sour gummies.
Woo! These are really good. And you can like pop these at any point in the day. Although these are the 1,000 milligrams, so I haven't tried this yet.
But. Starting Wednesday, September 7th, that is today, all CBD gummies will be 30% off with the coupon code GOODVIBE. That's one word, good vibe. And good vibe gummies are made from full spectrum CBD oil from Sunset Lake's hemp farm and can be delivered anywhere in the U.S. I'm going to try these tonight. I'll give a report on Friday, but Matt can give one at the end of the show.
Yeah, I'll let you know how I'm doing.
Don't fall asleep, Matt.
As soon as like the letters TH came out, he had already opened up the thing. Sunset Lake CBD is a major employee owned business. It pays minimum wage of $20 an hour. Good for them. They raised it. In 2021, Sunset Lake CBD donated more than $26,000 to anti-drug war organizations, animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. These guys are full-on movement partners. Again, starting Wednesday, September 7th, all CBD gummies will be 30% off with the coupon code GOODVIBE. Visit sunsetlakecbd.com to try these amazing new products and take advantage of this sale while it lasts. Sale ends September 12th, so get on it. 30% off, folks. Also, if you're like any other human being in this country, I would assume, every day you are getting some email, some attempt to phish, to get your personal information. I am super uptight about this. Fortunately, I have never had my identity stolen. And I'm very uptight about it. I go through all sorts of hoops to avoid this. But one of the biggest lines of defense is Aura. I use it to protect myself. They're one of our sponsors. Aura is identity theft protection, also fraud monitoring and antivirus software all combined into one easy-to-use app. Now, you may have one of these services already, but if you don't have all the tools, it's like locking the front door but leaving the back door wide open. That's the best metaphor for me. It's like the what we learned during coronavirus, right? It's like Swiss cheese, but the more layers you put on it, the denser it becomes. Or if you want polarized glasses, you can come up with a bunch of different these things. Those who have had their identity stolen are the biggest advocates of protection like these because they are shocked when it happens and they realize that it can happen to anybody. Just imagine yourself trying to log in one day to your email address and the password's been changed hours ago. Then all of a sudden you start getting notifications from your bank, your credit cards, whatever it is. Scary. An unfortunate reality for one American every 14 seconds. Thankfully, Aura monitors the dark web for your emails, passwords, and social security numbers and sends alerts fast right to your phone and email. Told you the story. I inputted, I have multiple email addresses that I use for different accounts. But my big one that I put in there, I got back a half a dozen alerts that it had been stolen in different places. And frankly, I didn't even remember signing up for a lot of these sites. It had been years ago. That happens in the first, 30 seconds. But then Aura gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries. Someone's going to open up a loan or a credit card in your name. You can protect your family and yourself from identity theft at aura.com/majority. When you sign up right now, Aura is going to give you 2-week free trial with this link. So you can see for yourself how many times Aura finds you or your family members' personal info on the dark web. If you sign up, let me know in the comments and our YouTube chat. If your personal information has been compromised, you will not regret checking. Again, that's aura.com/majority to try Aura for free for 14 days. And lastly, one of our sponsors today, Imi Ramen Noodles. These are great. And I didn't realize, they're healthier than your typical ramen noodles.
Those are usually packed with a ton of sodium.
Ton of sodium, but not Imi. Each serving of Imi ramen noodles has only 6 net carbs. It has 21 grams of protein. It is 100% plant-based and dairy-free. It has 18 grams of fiber, up to 4 times more fiber than any other instant ramen brands. And unlike other instant ramen brands, which is, like you say, high in sodium and preservatives, Imi has up to 35% less sodium than competitors. So you don't get that post-ramen bloat, and you're not just full of sodium. It's super easy to prepare. You just pop the Imi in a microwave or on the stovetop. You can have a bowl ready in 7 minutes. Comes in delicious, comforting plant-based flavors like spicy beef, tom yum shrimp, or I say tom yum kung, because I know a little bit of Thai.
You're cultured.
Yeah. And black garlic chicken. It's also great. Milo has been saying, my daughter's going to school. She gets out at noon every day now for her senior year.
Wow.
It's insane. And she's like, I need stuff for lunch. And I'm like, yeah, I know.
There you go.
Bingo bango. She loves ramen. Imi only uses the highest quality ingredients for their noodles and soup base with no unnatural preservatives. It's delicious, folks. It really is. I had no idea. It's also healthier. Imi has given my audience $5 off when you go to imieats.com/majority report and use the code majority report at checkout. That's IMMIEATS, imieats.com/majority report. Use the code majority report, one word, for $5 off. The link is in the YouTube and podcast description. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to John Bartlett, journalist and co-host of the Maratus podcast, about the recent rejection of a new constitution in Chile. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the program John Bartlett. He is a correspondent for The Guardian in Chile. Also, you can see his writing in the New York Times, other publications. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So The new constitution failed to pass by a pretty wide margin. I mean, an extraordinarily wide margin, it feels like to me, 62-38%. Let's just back up. Chile has been operating under a constitution that was essentially rewritten more or less the same. Some of the structures are there. Maybe some of the details have changed over the years. But that was developed under under Pinochet, who came in to power in Chile on the backs of a coup, throwing out Salvador Allende back in 1973. Give us a sense of like what that constitution, what led us to this point, I guess, in terms of where there was a plebiscite saying where the Chilean people said we want a new constitution.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very long story, and it kind of depends where you want to start with it. I mean, firstly, you're right. I mean, the result this weekend was emphatic. It was an emphatic rejection of a constitution which would have guaranteed indigenous rights for the first time in Chile, or recognized Chile's indigenous peoples for the first time in the country's history, would have guaranteed gender parity, gender equality, and prioritized tackling climate change. So that's kind of where we've got to now. The road to this point, and the future is very uncertain, but the road to this point was an arduous one. As you say there, in 1973, the Pinochet coup d'etat deposed Salvador Allende. And in 1980, the dictatorship drafted and then ratified through a questionable referendum its own constitution without democratic input, which what it did was enshrine the sort of neoliberal model, which was devised with the help of the Chicago Boys, this group of academics at the University of Chicago. And then imposed on Chile, and it kind of became this laboratory for neoliberalism, which obviously around the world we've seen it happen over and over again. Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, is really good on explaining kind of how that's been implemented in different places. But what it did essentially was wait for kind of a sort of critical juncture, like a big sort of event, to then impose neoliberal reforms in the wake of it. And the coup d'etat in Chile was the one that they chose down here in South America. So, you know, from then we've had this kind of constant idea of changing the constitution. That it's not a legitimate one. They want to make sure that we have a democratically legitimate sort of future and charter for the country. But that's been a movement that's been bubbling under for a long time. Then in October 2019, we had this mass wave of protests, which kind of exploded almost overnight. I mean, ostensibly over a metro fare rise in the rush hour metro fare in Santiago. And that brought a huge number of demands to the surface. And the political way out of that was to have a peace accord, a pact signed by the heads of the major parties, notably not the Communist Party, which is a very large party in Chile and holds quite a lot of power. And that paved the way towards replacing the constitution. So that was in November 2019, and we ended up with this long road towards replacing the Pinochet era document, which has now come to a shuddering halt.
I mean, it's pretty stunning to go from 2019, where 60% of people vote to change the constitution, to 3 years later, more or less, where they like you say, emphatically reject what is written. Like, what is there a sense? And I know there was a tremendous amount like disinformation and electioneering, you know, plays a big part of this. But is there a sense of, you know, what elements of this constitution were the ones that really, you know, got people to vote against? And we should say voting is mandatory in Chile, right? I mean, I know it was mandatory for this plebiscite. Was it also mandatory for the last one?
No. So voting is usually voluntary in Chile. The last vote that was obligatory was the 2015 elections in 2015. I think was the last time that people had to vote. So I mean, Chile has this sort of long history with, elections since then have been characterized by low participation. So we don't often get people vote. I mean, actually the entry plebiscite for this whole process was held in October 2020. And at that point we had just under 80% of the people who voted, and the turnout wasn't particularly high, partly due to the pandemic. Some of that was apathy as well. I think you find that quite a lot in Chile. But you know, you had this great mandate for a new constitution. You know, everybody, you know, a huge number of people turned out to say, no, we want to, you know, turn over the page on this chapter and have a democratically legitimate future under a new constitution. To then come to the point we've come to now, and this vote obviously was obligatory. And the mandate was huge as well. I mean, this wasn't just like a blip or a flash in the pan. This was, you know, the mandate was incredible. I mean, I think it was about, you know, mid-80s in terms of the percentage of the people who voted this weekend on Sunday. About 13 million people in a population were electoral roll of about 15 million. So it's an amazing number of people turned out. So I think the democracy of it is unquestionable. In terms of the things that made it difficult to approve, and I think that was it, rather than, you know, kind of an overwhelming kind of, you know, kind of a blanket sort of hatred of the proposal that was on offer. There was a shake-up of the political system, which many thought was unnecessary. The constitution kind of put forward this idea of abolishing the Senate and replacing it with a Chamber of Regions, which again was a very experimental body. No one really knew how that would have worked in practice. And then there were worries as well. I mean, kind of the conservative vote was very, very influential there. It enshrined reproductive rights. It allowed abortions, for example. It would also have, enshrined a huge number of social rights that I think people saw as maybe a bit fiscally irresponsible. It would have been very difficult to see where the money would have come from to pay for some of those things. But I think in practice, you know, I think that there would have been a way. I think you know, there's always a way of funding those kind of social programs. So I think it was, you know, it was, rather than this being a bad constitution, I think it was a difficult one to approve. I think it's easy to find something out of the 388 articles that were included. It was an incredibly long constitution that you're not in agreement with. And I think that a lot of people kind of, you know, found certain things and said, well, this isn't for me, or perhaps agreed with kind of the majority of it, but not certain things that they thought were completely, you know, completely non-starters, like the political system, for example. So it was a very complicated choice. I don't know how many people actually read this constitution. I imagine not very many. It was very long. You can't really expect people to either. I mean, the messaging did change as well from early on in the campaigns, where everyone was saying, oh, you should go out and read the constitution. It was, you know, the copy of the text was a bestseller in Chile for a long time during the campaign. So it was amazing, the kind of this sort of civic education that came along with this. But even so, I think that when you've got 13 million people voting, not all of them are doing so in an informed way, but ultimately that's not what decided this. You know, there were legitimate reasons to vote against the constitution, and ultimately I think people saw those and decided that it wasn't the future that they wanted. Although I do think that people still want a new constitution.
But the old constitution is unpopular, right? And so the Pinochet era constitution, can you give us a sense of what are some of the pillars of it that people take umbrage with, that are unpopular? What makes it such a neoliberal hallmark? And, you know, what about it was contrasted with this new proposal?
Yeah, so the proposal that we had this time enshrined, as I say, a huge number of rights. A lot of those were sort of, you know, correcting the course from the 1980 document. So housing, for example, the right to housing is not mentioned by the 1980 constitution. Chile's indigenous peoples are not recognized. They're not mentioned in the 1980 constitution. The water rights system is incredibly unpopular. It's being reformed, or has been reformed recently, but still is a kind of private sort of market system for administering water rights, even though water itself is a public good in Chile. And, you know, kind of whole communities were left without water, essentially, which was sort of siphoned off, you know, in favor of sort of agricultural plantations and forestry, which are the sort of backbones of the Chilean economy, along with mining. So, you know, it was a neoliberal constitution. The provision of services was as a subsidiary model. I mean, this is all quite technical, but I mean, it's a subsidiary model in which the state didn't really have a role in providing for people's needs, or the role it did have was that it was sort of plugging the gap that the private sector or the markets couldn't kind of provide for people. So essentially what the new constitution, or what the proposed constitution would have done, would have kind of, you know, kind of redressed that model and made the, you know, given the state more of a role in people's lives. And, you know, it's the endless kind of the endless debate as to how big a state should be, how it should be funded, and kind of what sort of role it should have in people's lives. But it did swing the needle back the other way towards, you know, a larger state and the government having more of a role.
How much, I mean, I'm curious, you know, I don't want to analogize, you know, elections here within Chile. I don't know how elections are won or lost there. But for instance, you know, in Kansas, we just had a referendum on abortion, and Kansans voted to maintain the right to abortion there. And the thrust of the campaign that won was very much focused on the idea of freedom as opposed to reproductive freedom. It was really very focused on freedom from government, in this case, the state government. I'm curious, based upon your observations, like, what were the major themes that drove it? Because you look at the polling, one third voted no, but want a new constitution. One third voted yes, despite reservations about this one. The people who wanted a new constitution but didn't like this constitution represented like two third of the population. Were there major sort of, I guess, campaign themes that were focused on? Because obviously with that many provisions, everybody could find something not to like. But was the scary one the idea of changing the structure of the government? Was it some pushback against the idea of indigenous people? What were the themes? And I'm just throwing these up just because you've mentioned them in the course of this conversation. But what were the major themes that you think moved most of the no votes?
So I think the misinformation is hard to overlook. As I say, you can't really expect people to be to cast, a completely informed vote. I don't think, I think a handful of people, truly understand kind of this constitution, how it was supposed to have worked in practice. So, I mean, I think the misinformation was a big factor. But also I think that, it was the way in which a lot of these rights were enshrined, I think people objected to. So, for example, gender parity was the body that drafted this new constitution was gender equal, but the way it was enshrined in this constitution, the proposal was basically making 50% of all organs of the state, as well as state companies and kind of public private companies as well. 50% of those companies had to be women, so it was always 50% as a floor rather than a ceiling, and that made people push back a little bit against that. This idea that there was a sort of limit on the number of men that could be in it, but then women could effectively in theory have made up more of the more of these institutions. Indigenous rights as well. It was enshrined as a plurinational sort of framework, which is quite a technical, very Latin American concept, which basically recognizes states and their cultures and traditions and histories within one overarching state. And people not with a huge amount of credence to this, but people basically interpreted that as dividing Chile into kind of separate states and regions and nations, which people didn't want to see. There's a lot of kind of national symbols and things became part of the debate. The Chilean flag became a huge thing, latterly in the campaign. So I think it was the way these things were enshrined rather than anything. And then the kind of the icing on the cake, I think, for a lot of people is this sort of experimental idea of how the political system would have worked, how judicial independence would have been exercised in practice. There were a lot of these kind of regulatory bodies that were created by the proposed constitution as well, to oversee a lot of the kind of, parts of or the institutions and the kind of functions of the state. So that made things very difficult. I just think that more than this being a bad constitution, I don't think it was a bad constitution. I think it was I think the problem was it was difficult to approve. I think it's very difficult to...
Too many. I mean, when you have that many new provisions, everybody can find something they don't like on some level. And I imagine it there's a target-rich environment to vote no on. So with that said, what happens next? I mean, have you had any chance to do any reporting with people who are promoting the Constitution? Do they have a sense like we should have handled this in a different way, maybe done this in stages or less structural change to the government and more sort of, or what? Like, do you have a sense of both A, what the takeaway is from those who want to pass a new constitution, and B, like what the plan is?
Yeah, so I think there's a fear of change overall. I think it wasn't a radical constitution, but it would have been a radical departure from the constitution we have now. I think that was partly what drove people not to vote in its favour. In terms of what happens next, I was at the presidential palace yesterday for the cabinet reshuffle that the president has just done. You know, the idea there is to sort of incorporate more of the older guard, the older generation, because the president's 36 years old. Like, a lot of his sort of former student leader friends and associates are in his cabinet. One of them has just been dismissed from the cabinet as interior minister, but she had a very turbulent period. She'll be back. I mean, she's a very capable politician, but the cabinet reshuffle was one thing. I think there's a broader need for dialogue. In terms of this constitution, the proposal that we voted on at the weekend, that Chileans voted on at the weekend, now has no legal footing. That's no longer relevant. That's gone. But what I think that we do have is a precedent. I think a lot of these things, like, there are certain advancements, like gender parity, for example, the recognition of indigenous peoples. These things need to be part of Chile's future. There needs to be a new document written, and these things are going to be part of it. But technically, none of them need to be. I mean, like, you could, if you wanted, draw a line under this process and say none of that ever happened. Here we go again. And so what we're doing now is going to be there are two options. One is to reform the current constitution, the very unpopular 1981. It's very difficult to reform as well, although they have managed to lower the quorums required in both houses of Congress to reform it. And the other is to start all over again with a whole new constitutional process, re-elect a convention, which seems to be the most likely route at the moment, re-elect a convention, perhaps with compulsory participation in that first vote. And that seems to be the way we're likely to go. But, you know, there's certainly a risk that we sort of tumble through these endless constitutional processes, and it just ends up dragging on and on. So, I mean, the future is very uncertain. I think by the end of the week, we'll know a little bit better as to, you know, kind of what the future holds. But I really don't know at the moment. It's all very raw after, you know, kind of 3 days after the vote.
How supportive was the government of the new constitution? I mean, it presumably came out of a process that was associated with it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's going to, on balance, where was the government relative to the constitution?
Yeah, it was very difficult for them, and that they, you know, obviously had to remain, you know, nominally impartial at least. The government spokeswoman, Camila Vallejo, she gave an interview in August where she said that they, you know, for the ambitious agenda that they have, this sort of, you know, expanding social programs and kind of, you know, tackling inequality essentially is what they wanted to do. She said that they couldn't do that with the 1980 constitution. I mean, it didn't allow for it. It has too many sort of stumbling blocks for them to be able to do that. So, you know, in that sense, she was effectively coming out in favor of the new constitution, but they've kind of distanced themselves from it. And what the right did very well was kind of make this, associate the project as much as they could with the president, who has been, you know, battered in the polls. He's not done a particularly bad job, but I mean, it's not a government that anybody wants around the world at the moment, after the pandemic, with inflation as it is, with wars in Europe. I mean, it's a very difficult time for everybody to be governing. So his popularity has been hit quite a lot, and he kind of had to sort of distance himself. Although everybody knew ideologically this proposed constitution would have benefited him and his government and helped him implement his agenda, but now he's got a very different kind of reform on his hands, I think.
And another quick question as well, in terms of the fact that Chile has such expansive lithium reserves, that was the focus of, there was some op-ed in the Washington Post about how maybe this new constitution isn't such a great thing. Like, how has industry played into some of the disinformation that you've seen, particularly because of just, you know, the role that could be played by that much lithium going towards batteries and cell phones and laptops and things like that?
Yeah, I think that certainly increased the interest in what was happening here in Chile. You know, there was a lot of discussion about mining royalties in the debate over the new constitution. That op-ed, I mean, kicking it off with the comment about lithium, sort of saying we want your lithium but not like this, was a strange decision. But ultimately, I think a lot of people kind of came out and said that that they didn't want to, a lot of people came out around the world and said that this constitution wasn't actually apt for, sorry, someone knocking at the door. They're saying this constitution wasn't apt for the, for the country that Chile was. So the lithium is obviously going to be very important around the world for this green energy transition. It's going to be really, really interesting to see how Chile goes about that. But we've really, sorry, someone knocking.
No worries.
No.
Go answer it. Wow. Feel free. Go answer.
Yes.
We will.
No, don't worry. It's fine. Okay. I'm sure it's fine.
All right. Well, we do appreciate your catching us up on this, and maybe we'll check back in and get a sense, somewhere down the road on what the progress is going. Mm-hmm. Really appreciate it, John Bartlett, correspondent for The Guardian in Chile.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We are still waiting for our second guest. Apparently, our second guest is actually in a meeting with the EPA right now, the federal EPA.
Yep.
So that's probably a bit more important.
Yes. She was going to talk to us about the water emergency in Jackson. That Mark Maron and I used to do a show before we did our show for Air America. I was living upstate, and he was in L.A., and we did a show. I think we did about 12 or 13 episodes on some technology very similar to the one we're using now, but this was 14 years ago, and it was not a commercial technology, and it was just a guy had come up with it, and it was a little bit shaky, but Maron and I would do this, and he very often would just have, oh, wait, hold on for a second. The guy to fix my washing machine is here. And then the guy would walk through frame, and Mara would be talking. I could see the guy working in the background on the dishwasher. And I was hoping for one of those moments. But, correspondent for The Guardian, they're a little bit, they don't realize how loosey-goosey we can get.
Right. They're professionals.
All right. Well, let's do a couple of stuff. I really do want to speak to Nishambe Lambright. She's the executive director of One Voice Mississippi. We're waiting on her. So, we may mess around with the format a little bit, and we will take her when she comes. Let's just take a hard turn. I don't know if you guys remember the debate that we had with this guy, Jason Hinkle. Jackson Hinkle, sorry. He billed himself as a communist, a patriot communist. Was that what it was?
Socialist patriot or something like that. He had Marxist-Leninist in the bio.
Oh, wait, that's what it was. Marxist-Leninist patriot.
But that
patriot.
Disappeared quickly.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Shortly after our debate, I'm not sure that that's why. A lot of people said, that something went awry with him. I would argue that there was something awry even before then. But he was very, very upset that I was okay with a 12% increase in a budget for the State Department. Incidentally, the attrition of diplomats during the Trump years was huge. Certainly, there are some programs the State Department runs that are essentially CIA adjacent, which I have problems with. But I also do believe that we need a State Department because it is often a State Department that will help us avoid a war. Generally, they're less powerful than the Defense Department.
But it's supposed to be a vehicle for diplomacy, at least in the I don't know.
And that's the vast majority of its mission.
Right.
But apparently that was a real problem, because I guess he was anti-imperialist, but I guess that also ultimately means you're okay with other people starting wars.
I'll look
very
at him.
Odd.
He fits right in, really, right?
He's a little campus, yeah. But
he looks like every other Republican guest they've had on.
In part of the sort of clique of folks who go on to Tucker Carlson's show. Generally, we don't follow it too much. I mean, I know folks like Glenn Greenwald go on, well, Tucker and all over Fox on a daily basis. Folks like Jimmy Dore and this and that. Tucker, I think, likes to promote certain people who at least, self-identify as being on the left. He likes to promote them on his network.
He likes to stir shit a little bit, I think you would say.
And generally, like, I don't really pay much attention to it. But this one only came to my attention because this is about as sort of like, I mean, we're getting super, super close to some full on Protocols of Zion stuff here, frankly. But you tell me. I mean, this is an interesting theory that this guy has got. I've been told, like, apparently, like, 5 years ago was campaigning for Hillary Clinton. He's had quite a journey, but here.
Left to take your side. But for Biden to get up there and say the single biggest threat to our country is anyone who opposes me in the coming midterm elections and the media.
Oh, pause it. We should set this up. They're still complaining about Joe Biden's
the Dark Brandon speech.
The Dark Brandon speech where Biden is saying that there is a problem in the Republican Party. And I don't know if people have noticed this, but there was, and the Justice Department, I don't know if they're arguing that the Justice Department, all these prosecutions of these people are political prisoners or something. But they are arguing that by going out and letting people know that there was some type of like fascist insurrection, that and the number of Republican lawmakers who are supportive of it is problematic. That's what they don't like, the fact that Joe Biden said that. I'm not saying they're trying to censor Joe Biden, but that's what they don't like.
Suppress him.
I'm going to take your side. But for Biden to get up there and say the single biggest threat to our country is anyone who opposes me in the coming midterm elections and the media to nod along makes you think we've crossed some kind of line.
We have crossed the line, Tucker, and it's so interesting that, anyone in the media today would be saying that they liked what Joe Biden said in that speech because it was a dictator-inspired speech. Not only that, but it seems like a lot of the practices and the actions that the Biden administration is...
Well, let's just ruminate on what a dictator-inspired speech was. What did he call for in that speech?
The aesthetics of it, though, kind of
the
looks
scary
like...
lighting, Sam.
Yeah, right. Don't you understand?
I mean, I do think the lighting was weird, but
it was like V for Vendetta.
No, yeah. it's like a sophomore in college going through some sort of emo phase and saying, "Oh, my lighting's going to be a little red or dark this time."
Oh,
right?
And also saying a dictator-inspired speech. But go ahead.
What Joe Biden said in that speech, because it was a dictator-inspired speech. Not only that, but it seems like a lot of the practices and the actions that the Biden administration is employing in the United States right now that were reflected in that speech are very closely aligned with what the dictator Zelensky is doing in Ukraine. Joe Biden is plunging us into a fascist state, and he is taking cues from what Zelensky is doing in Ukraine to manufacture this dystopian state and this dystopian reality.
Pause it for 1 second.
What is Zelensky doing?
Zelensky is inspiring Joe Biden. What are the dictatorial moves that Joe Biden has done? Well, he's done some unilateral moves. He's followed the Zelensky plan of relieving only $10,000 worth of debt.
Basically Hitler.
For college students or people who have attended some college, I should say, college debt. I mean, haven't we been calling for him to do more unilaterally? I'm not sure exactly, like, what is he doing that Zelensky has inspired? I mean, aside from Zelensky also being elected. But what has, what?
He's trying to shoehorn Ukraine into this conversation because I guess...
That's where his YouTube hits Hinkle's, come from.
Yeah, you know, hits have been pro-Russia, right?
Yeah, a lot of these guys who were just doing anti-COVID stuff are really lucky that they can pose as anti-imperialists with the Ukraine stuff.
You know, there was about 6 months ago, maybe a little bit more, right around the start of the invasion by Russia of Ukraine. Let's just remind people of that. The bombing and the invasion and the killing and the attacking by Russia of Ukraine. I spoke to someone at YouTube because they were coming out with a new feature for YouTube YouTubers where you could search. You could get a sense of what the difference between what people were searching for and what was being provided for. And there was a big gap in Ukraine war coverage on YouTube. And, you know, I don't really, well, I don't at all program the show that way. There's only so much that we had to offer in that in terms of commentating. But then you could see all of a sudden, everybody, once that feature came out, you could see certain people immediately just shift everything when they had probably never mentioned the word Ukraine or Russia before on their channel. It went all there because that's where the clicks were.
And also, if you're providing alternate coverage that diverges from the mainstream, that's perfect, right? He's filling a vacuum by saying Zelensky is the one who is the dictator and the authoritarian when, as you say, Sam, just a quick reminder, Russia invaded Ukraine,
yes,
not the other way around.
And we should also be clear that, you know, when you have two sides in a conflict, one side is going to seek out people who are supporting their side as much as possible.
It makes people feel good if they're, you know, inherently skeptical of the mainstream media or narratives, dominant narratives, to feel confident in an alternative narrative. And that's what Hinkle's providing, it seems. Like, I don't follow his career. I'm not an avid The Dive listener. But that's what it seems to be, right?
All right, continue.
Is plunging us into a fascist state, and he is taking cues from what Zelensky is doing in Ukraine to manufacture this dystopian state and this dystopian reality in America. And there's no real surprise for me there, because at the end of the day, Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and Joe Biden are controlled by the same exact people. They're controlled by individuals like George Soros and controlled by people like Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum, and they're going to do whatever they want. You know, to put it quite simply, Zelensky's using the intelligence community in Ukraine and the Nazi Azov thugs in Ukraine to silence freedom-loving Ukrainians. Joe Biden in the United States, though he can't remember what he had for breakfast this morning or who his wife is, his handlers and his cronies are prepping the CIA, the FBI, Antifa, the IRS, and now Ministry of Truth to attack freedom-loving Americans.
Wow. That's
a lot of names.
Tucker's like, usually I'd be a little more subtle for my white supremacist audience with some of the anti-Jew stuff.
Well, look, there's a one world cabal that is controlling both Zelensky and Biden, despite the fact that Biden doesn't know where he is. And George Soros sits atop of it.
And people like George Soros.
You know what I mean.
That's... I don't know. I get the feeling that the Jason's parents are pretty Jackson's parents are feeling a little bit annoyed with their son. You recall
he's going to get a stern talking to.
Well, his father was mocking him openly on Twitter a while back, and I guess that was the
about like the tooth fairy or something like that. Wasn't that?
Like, that no, it was no. Yes, no. I think he claimed like. There was a lot of stuff that his parents told him that were lies. And
oh, right.
His father came back and said, "We never told you any of that. You're making that up to
brand yourself."
To brand yourself. But that's pretty good stuff. What's going to be interesting is to see if they ever have him back on. They may say, like, you may want to just tone it down just a little bit. We're into dog whistles here, not full on, horn blowing. That was
also, you're supposed to be like a leftist. So can you do some like a little bit more leftist stuff instead of just sounding like a younger version of, Mark Levin?
Right. Exactly. Although I will say this, is there anybody who can deny that Joe Biden was meeting with Antifa to enlist them in part of his like Antifa FBI CIA group of thugs
to come after patriots
freedom loving patriots? There you have it, folks. That was an interesting that was definitely an interesting shift. All right, well, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nashambe Lambright. She's the executive director of One Voice Mississippi about the crisis that is going on in Jackson, Mississippi. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report joining us, and with Emma Viglin joining us is Nashambe Lambright. She's executive director of One Voice Mississippi. She has just gotten out of a meeting with the EPA director, who ostensibly, you were telling us, had a scheduled visit. Maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not. But Michael Regan showed up, wanted to meet with community stakeholders. Before we get into how we got here today, what is the federal government talking about doing? Are they in a listening stage or in a we're ready to deploy stuff stage?
I think from what I gathered from the conversation, it's a little bit of both. And I have to say that this is Administrator Regan's second time in Jackson. He did his Journey to Justice, I believe that's what it was called, tour back in the winter. It may have been November or December of 2021. And Jackson was his first stop, I believe. And so we were having water problems then. That was actually in the midst of our winter storm when he came last year. So, you know, he's more than familiar with Jackson's water problems. So I think that this visit was really about solidifying some of the plans that, you know, the city has already made, and about, you know, talking about how to get the city federal funding that's, you know, directly earmarked for cities like Jackson that are having these infrastructure problems. And of course, you know, when you're talking about federal funds, most of these federal funds have to go through state agencies. So there's a process.
I read a piece in preparation to talk to you by Nick Juden, who is a local reporter there. He wrote this piece back in 2021, I think it was, which outlined sort of like broad strokes why in 2022 we have this disaster in Jackson. And the story starts in the 70s. and it involves white flight outside of the center of Jackson, 200,000 people, but then all of a sudden Metro Jackson gets larger. You have people who move outside the city. The infrastructure of the water infrastructure for Jackson gets spread out. Obviously, density is easier to deal with. Ronald Reagan comes in, starts, in addition to the requirements that we saw in the 70s for cleaner water and cleaner rivers and whatnot, Ronald Reagan comes in and cuts all the funding for the EPA and for infrastructure at that time. And, you know, we were talking about this in the office. It takes a long time for pipes to break. It takes a long time for infrastructure that has been built to break down. But 40 years sounds about right if it's been, you know, there's no funding to neglect it. And that's where we are today. Will you talk about where we've been for the past couple of years? Because there are two water treatment plants, is my understanding, in Jackson. The OB Curtis, I think it is, in J.H. Fellwell Water Treatment. And there's multiple problems associated with this, both in the physical plant and in terms of personnel.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I have to say that the problems began long before the 70s. But I think that that's when the city government started learning about the problems, from my reading and understanding. And I'm a lifelong Jackson native. I was born in 1973 here in Jackson. And so I've been able to see kind of like the path that the city has gone down. And that white flight is definitely a significant issue with the infrastructure failing. And with that white flight, the investment in the city, in businesses, in entertainment and recreation also left the city. And so that has also led to the problem that we're in now. And so I think that what we're seeing is that, you know, different government agencies and different administrations have attempted to fix it. They know it's a long-range problem. They've sort of put Band-Aids over it. But no one has, you know, and everyone knows that it's a billion-dollar problem, but I only have a couple of hundred thousand, so I'm just going to do what I can to get through it. And that's what we've seen over the last several decades.
Tell us what's going on right now on the ground.
Right now on the ground, you have the city, you have FEMA, and you have EPA folks are working around the clock to make sure that the plant is running and that everyone is getting water, and so that the water pressure has been restored to the main plant. So every citizen now does have water. Now,
you still got to boil it. You can't
drink
it.
Have to boil. Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, I don't think people understood that, like, there was no running water. Never mind.
Right.
Like, you couldn't wash anything. You couldn't boil water. There was no running water. You couldn't
water.
Go
it flush toilets.
Couldn't
exactly.
flush toilets. I mean, that's this is a
right.
serious health jeopardy.
Serious health issue. That's right. So for some citizens, they waited 2 weeks for running water, period. So everyone has running water now. Now we get to the point where we're dealing with the boil water notices. So every citizen is still boiling water to wash dishes, you know, feed your pets, and also, you know, to brush your teeth with and to cook with as well. And so community agencies.
160,000 people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so community groups all over the city are giving out water on a daily basis. We're doing, you know, drive-bys where people are able to pull up in their cars, and also delivering to elderly residents and residents without vehicles or who may be disabled. And that's been going on for the past couple of weeks as well.
So can you talk about the what happened in 2013 with the Siemens contract that was, what was it, $90 billion or something like that to fix the water system. And it ended up going so awry that there was a lawsuit, if I'm not mistaken. What went so wrong there? And do you draw that as, do you draw a straight line from what happened during that failed effort to revamp the water system to what you're experiencing today?
Yeah, you know, I don't know the details of what happened with the Siemens contract, but I do know that that was expected to help fix what was going wrong with the billing of our water system in terms of how each citizen is billed every month. And that was supposed to fix that in terms of installing new meters at each residence in Jackson. And so I don't know if it had a lot to do with what was going on at the plant, but it was definitely supposed to help with the billing for citizens. And something went very wrong. And as a result, the city filed a lawsuit and was successful in it. And now we have new meters now at our homes that have been installed.
Gotcha.
What about concerns involving things like lead and mercury? I mean, it's one thing to boil your water. You'll deal with, you know, I guess, bacteria and whatnot. But when you're talking about lead and mercury and you're talking about a water system that is so stressed and so in such disrepair that you can't even get legitimate water pressure. I got to imagine the idea of degrading pipes and leaching heavy metals in the water. That's got to be, I mean, that has to be, I mean, all over the place in that water supply. What would, do you have a sense of what's going on with on that front?
I don't, but that's a big concern of ours because, you know, we have the winter is approaching and every winter, you know, we have a number of pipes that burst and the city's way of addressing our corroded pipes has been, hey, when the pipes burst, we'll go ahead and fix them because we don't have the money just to dig every pipe up in the city right now. So as they break, we'll fix them. And so, you know, as we approach another winter, we, you know that we're going to probably experience a lot of pipes bursting and another, you know, big winter storm where we're without water again.
What what's the relationship between the city and the state in terms of this? Like, I mean, you say that, you know, federal money's coming through, but it filters through the state. Is there a sense in your community that the state is getting you all that money that might be earmarked from the federal government? Yeah, I mean, I could have anticipated that answer, but give me a better sense of what the feeling is there in terms of how cooperative the state has been.
Yeah, not cooperative. And you can go back and look at some of the governor's press conferences to see he's been saying things like he doesn't trust the city's management. And even going back to the governor's State of the State address back during the legislative session in January, where the city had asked for a bunch of infrastructure funds. And he said that he wasn't going to fund anything for Jackson because the crime was so bad and that crime was the number one priority in Jackson. And so, you know, he has held firm to that. And so now he's come in and made a bunch of very disparaging remarks about the city of Jackson, which, you know, as a citizen of Jackson, I take, you know, personally, you know, about the mismanagement of funds and the mismanagement of a system. And it's all leading up to this kind of sense that Jackson can't run itself and we're not going to spend any money here unless some sort of private firm comes in to manage things. And so it just feels like a big setup for privatization.
Well, it's also, and doing so by, I mean, let's be explicit about it. He's making seemingly racist appeals to the rest of the state and using that as a way to justify austerity when, I mean, this crisis, as you outlined, it could not be more serious what the residents of Jackson are going through right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, Secretary Reagan is meeting, you know, with the mayor and governor today. I'm hoping that with $400 billion on the line through the infrastructure bill, that the governor will kind of put, you know, these differences aside and that, you know, the governor and the mayor can work together to go ahead and make sure this funding comes to the city. So we'll see.
Just for folks who don't realize, Jackson is the biggest city in Mississippi by a factor of at least two, right? Maybe it's two. It's the also capital the capital. It's the capital city. It also is approximately like 80% black.
Absolutely.
As well. And so there is, I mean, it really is about a lot of racial politics. It feels like that things are being exploited there.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And that's the sense that we've had for the past, you know, few decades. And, you know, this fight started with our airport, with the state trying to take over our airport. And then the very next year, the state attempted to take over our school district. The community fought back and, you know, that attempt was not successful either. And so here's just another thing that's kind of being thrown in our face saying, hey, Jackson, you know, you can't take care of yourselves. And so it's very discouraging, but at the same time, it's an opportunity for us as Jacksonians to really stand up to show that once we get the federal funds and we can get this problem fixed, we can lead.
Is there any way to get the federal funds directly, or does it all have to go through the state?
I think that it will have to be some sort of process through Congress where the funds are earmarked directly to Jackson. But the way that the funds are designated now through ARPA and through this infrastructure bill is just like available to cities in need. And so it's not earmarked to specific cities. And so that's why it has to be funneled through a state agency.
And the state agency has to determine which. And the state agency determines what city is in need. And
right.
People just need to sort of like contemplate the idea that the largest city in the state by a factor of at least two is without running water, without water that is potable, and that there should be any doubt as to what city's in need in that state. It really is stunning. It really is stunning.
Absolutely.
What else should we know at this point? And what can people outside of Mississippi do to help?
Well, like I said, we are continuing to give out water. There are a number of community organizations that are working in coalition under the umbrella of a Mississippi Disaster Relief Coalition. And they can, you know, Google that group. And if they want to make donations, this is going to be a long term thing because we know that even though the plant is up and running, we're still going to have to boil water for a while. So people can certainly give there. We're also interested in ideas about, we haven't had a chance to get to any of them yet, but we're also interested in ideas about community organizations working to establish clean water processes and filters at their homes. And so we have a lot of people that are calling us with ideas about neighborhood associations working to get their homes set up with filters. And so we're interested in any ideas like that moving forward.
What is your sense of how the city leadership is doing? I mean, I understand that they simply don't have the resources that they need to do anything. So with that, you know, with that caveat, what is your sense of how the mayor is doing and others in city government?
I know they're overwhelmed right now, but I think that with everyone pitching in, all of the community organizations, you know, coming to their aid and saying, hey, what can we do to help? They know that, you know, they have a strong community, a resilient community that has their back. So everyone's tired right now. Everyone's overwhelmed. Everyone's ready for this to end. But, you know, we're going to push through.
And quickly, what can people do in terms of if they wanted to donate and help out with your guys' efforts?
Yeah, they can visit that coalition site, and that's msdisasterreliefcoalition.org.
Okay. We'll put a link to that in our YouTube and our podcast description.
Yes, they can go to that site, and we have a link for volunteers and for donations on that site.
Nshambe Lambright, Executive Director of One Voice Mississippi, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's not even close. Like, the next largest city to Jacksonville has, like I say, half the population. Yeah. And, you know, I grew up in a city about that size, more or less the same size. And the idea that everyone in that city would not have, that everyone would not have running water is just, it's mind blowing.
And what does crime have to do with people having water? I mean, come on, we understand what's being said there.
Well, this is like, you know, the point about, you know, certain areas are going to be affected by climate change and that sort of thing. And we still have areas that are considered and, especially by the people who exploit them, third world countries. And we just allow them, whether it's Kentucky or Mississippi, like, work on it. You know, we'll get to you. But I mean, it's an acute problem, but it's also everywhere. Baltimore has a boil water notice too. I just saw, because there's E. coli in the pipes.
And just to say too, I know we talk about a lot of, you know, odious Republican governors here, DeSantis, Noem, et cetera. But, and we do, we have talked about Tate Reeves, the governor of Mississippi, before. But between COVID, abortion, and this problem, he is truly one of the most disgraceful officials that we have in this country.
Yep.
It is. And again, you know, and maybe, yeah, I'd love to get that writer, Nick, was it Rudin on?
Juden, yeah.
Nick,
yeah.
Juden.
We're working on it.
Because this story of the disinvestment that we saw in the 80s, this is the ultimate chickens coming home to roost moment, right? I mean, and frankly, we've seen it with infrastructure. We've seen it with many respects, human infrastructure in terms of like homelessness and in terms of, help for emotional and mental issues, which, you know, commingles with homelessness in many respects. And all that disinvestment that we saw starting in the 80s, it takes a while for stuff to break down.
Yeah.
It takes a while for stuff to break down, and both like human and physical infrastructure.
Well, it's like we talked about this last week on Left Reckoning, but like when Reagan comes and says the era of big government's over, like that means the federal government is going to stop helping your sewer systems advance to capacity that they need to be. And this is what happens.
Yep. All right. We are going to head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You can IM the show via our app at majorityapp.com. Folks, don't forget, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also help this show survive and thrive going forward. It is our members that keep this show trucking along. So if you enjoy the show a couple of times a week, become a member, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. You can get the Majority Report blend. It's a delicious brew of, it's like a medium and dark roast mixed together. I picked it out myself. yeah.
Glad you're not a light roast person. I mean, come on.
Well, you know, the funny thing is light roast actually has more caffeine.
More caffeine.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even
You wouldn't expect it.
You don't know, but that's the way that's true.
But I like the taste of the darker one. More bitter, the better for me.
Meanwhile, yesterday, somebody launched their, new show.
Like a Joe Burrow Hail Mary.
Yeah.
I would love to be Joe Burrow. He's
blew the doors off of the numbers and the comments, the number of comments.
Well, it's because I said that, you know, Trey Lance was a bust, and like I am not moving off of that. And
ooh, doing hot takes.
They were mad that we didn't open the phone lines yesterday, just because they wanted to yell at us over and over. Yeah.
Nothing makes someone madder than when you say your starting quarterback is not good.
It's bad.
I have admitted
Emma Bayless over here.
I have admitted that Daniel Jones is not the future. But so you can do the same for your team. It's really okay.
Skip there was one Bears fan who was so
upset. What'd you say?
It's Skip Vigeland.
Yeah, exactly.
Skip Vigeland.
Please, give me more respect than this.
I haven't been able to follow any part of this conversation. I haven't been able to follow a single part of
Also, why were Bears fans mad? I said I like Justin Fields as a player.
Well, we just said they were really not good.
They're going to be one of the worst three teams in the league.
All right. Well, folks, stop giving away for free.
Yeah,
all right. Go. Well, I mean, it's still free.
Tuesdays.
You can go. You can. For now, the full shows are going to play on the.
This channel. 4 p.m. Tuesdays.
4 p.m. Tuesdays, and then maybe something will go from there. I mean, yesterday
I have
we did
another
18 hours of the show.
Well, we wanted to take calls at the end, but Bradley and I were like an hour in. I realized we'd gotten through three divisions out of eight, and then we had more things we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I was tuning in while I was editing Majority Report, and I'm like, still on the NFC East.
Full conference to go 2 hours in.
So we'll make it tighter, but check that out, guys. And I created a YouTube channel. I'll put up some clips, but we're going to be streaming the full show on the Majority Report for the foreseeable future, and we're going to be doing it again Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern. Check out this latest episode where we gave NFL season previews in terms of like how the division order I foresee it shaking out, who my Super Bowl pick is. I'll leave that for you to watch. And then Bradley and I gave our three locks of the week against the spread. We're not encouraging gambling. It's just a fun way to talk about the games.
Certainly not.
We'll see. Bradley and I, we're going to have like a little competition between the two of us for the rest of the NFL season. He picked the Cowboys to beat the Buccaneers.
I can't wait to be
idiot.
My only gambling is this. This is my form of gambling, which is competing with Emma each week.
And I
will not put any money towards these.
If the Cowboys win, you have full permission to wipe this smug look off my face. So
I feel like I have a request for a segment on the show, which is like a 2 minute, maybe a 1 minute segment where it's like. Where you can where like a soy boy like myself with my skinny jeans and my peppermint latte
with soy whip
can pretend I know what I'm talking about with football.
Yeah.
So like you got a package, like a 1 minute thing where
dunk
like,
on the soy boy.
Well, no. So something where I can pretend like, you know, when I'm around like
this
the
is
guys
a great idea.
With the malls. They're like, what do you think about this week? And I'm like, oh, well, you got to watch out for blankety blank and blank blank. And then I can, sort of walk away. I got to go because I got a guy, I get more wood to chop.
Right.
You know, that type of thing.
And film it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so check it out, guys. We had a lot of fun and it'll be
awesome.
It'll be
music
fun.
Is cool.
It is cool. Thank you to Ava who put
Ava,
that together.
Ava Raisa.
Ava, sorry.
We are going to put. She's also the one who did our break music for the MR as well. So we're going to put her Bandcamp and our descriptions just so people can check out her music. She's great.
Yeah.
While we're thanking people, Oh, yeah. Get to the Matt Leckie media years. We got a package in the mail today.
Should I go grab this stuff to the show?
Yeah, I think these are beautiful. I love mine too, but I would like the Matt one. I popped that out and I was like, oh my gosh, this is
put it on the one shot and then just hand them to me.
This is from listener Heather from Ontario. She did a she did a really great painting of Michael in a spacesuit, and she did a great painting of me as a robot.
I love that painting,
which really captured my inner emotional capacity. but then today, these two showed up.
That's just nuts.
Absolutely beautiful. Wait a second.
That's really crazy. And also, it makes me look so much prettier than I am. I really appreciate it.
Such a beautiful painting. And then this one. Here, hand me that one, man. And then this one.
This one of Matt is, really whoa.
Amazing.
And I love how they incorporated all the books.
Das Kapital, Leviathan.
Right? I'm blown away by
that. Yeah.
Honestly, I saw this crazy. And I was like, oh my God. This doesn't look like me at all.
That's really incredible.
I love that painting.
I don't even know how. I'm just so bad at art. How do people do that?
I just love the various there's. You got. It's really one, two, three, four plus levels of depth in that. I just find that painting amazing. It's Heather from Ontario, longtime listener.
Heather, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Heather. I've never been painted before, and I'm not quite sure the posture I should take.
Matt's going to hang right above his bed.
Exactly. That's going to be the first thing you see when you walk into Matt's apartment.
Put on the door outside.
Yeah.
All right. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckin media universe, despite the fact that you're going to be spending the next show exclusively talking about your painting?
Appraising artworks, one specifically. Yeah, we had Charles Starr on last night for a good long conversation about the Trump raid and how he's not exactly like Daniel Ellsberg. they talked about Nixon and also the special master we talked about. So look for that. And also two topics that we talked about today, Jackson and Chile. David and I gave our takes on that. So about 2-hour public show last night. So patreon.com/leftreckoning if you want to hear that in the post game.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is number. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What?
what's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm
going
to go start
like. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3-8.
9-11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop. Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.